welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hey, Paul. It's good to be here with you again on OC Talk Radio. Now, today, I plan to dedicate our show to what I'm calling kind of an unsung but essential topic. I want to discuss the potential shortcomings related to economic and social aid to the developing world, or in old terminology, third world countries. Basically, the question is this. Is your investment in the poor and disenfranchised in developing world being administrated with longer-term needs of communities being considered, or is it more about short-term walk-away money? Big question. My guest, Daryl Larson, has vast philanthropical experience in several foreign countries, including Fiji, Philippines, and several countries in Africa. And both of us with hearts for developing the social change of, let's say, the most needy people in the world. Daryl and I will spend our time today discussing how oftentimes our desire to serve the poor and disenfranchised can frequently result in short-term benefit but longer-term disadvantage. I recently watched a documentary that would be interesting to all titled Poverty, Inc., a quite informative and a bit disturbing documentary that develops a concept that's stated in Steve Corbett's popular book, When Helping Hurts. The thesis is this. If we give resources such as money, or in my case with Wells of Life, water wells, without empowering communities to assume responsibilities of these gifts that we have given them, the result can be a dependence on foreign aid instead of independence, self-determination, and self-respect. Like the familiar adage, we are giving them fish, but not teaching them to fish. Today, Daryl and I are going to talk about the idea of projects with local communities versus projects to local communities. And I want to talk about three types of giving, and one is going to be a surprise to Daryl. I want to talk about relief giving, what that looks like, alleviation from poverty giving, and finally, developmental giving. My guest, Daryl Larson, is a seasoned vet in international affairs regarding poverty. He is currently international director of Sawyer Filters, which provides clean and safe water for thousands of homes across the world. Daryl is also founder of the nonprofit Give Clean Water and has served as outreach pastor at two churches in San Diego. I can't wait to get the show going. So let's bring on Daryl Larson. Daryl, welcome to the next chapter with Charlie.
Hey, Charlie. Nice to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I can't wait for this discussion. Tell me something, man. You have a boatload of experience in addressing poverty and social issues in countries in the developing world. What is it that drove you to work internationally as opposed to focus on serving the poor people in the United States?
That's a good question, and I often think of it in terms of maybe not so much either or, but both and. So I have my hands a little bit in both, but predominantly on the international side. And I think the very first time that I got involved with it was I was working with youth groups and teenagers specifically, and I was at a youth worker convention. And there was an opportunity during that convention to actually go down to Mexico and to build a house during that week for a family that was impoverished down there and didn't have a home. And I was always up for adventure, and I was actually kind of going with the purpose of kind of seeing with different eyes around the world and what the needs were around the world. And so this gave me a really hands-on opportunity to go. And I grew up in San Diego and hadn't really gone down to Mexico very often. And it was so crazy that just crossing the border, we went out into this very, just what were third world poverty conditions out on the outskirts of Tijuana. and went to a family's house, and I saw people living in cardboard and plastic and could barely get by, and they didn't have appropriate ways to, you know, really take care of their family in terms of shelter and those kind of things. And so in the course of 1 week, we immersed ourselves into this house build. And when I left at the end of the week, we gave the keys of the house to that family. And I knew this was something that I wanted the kids that I was working with, you know, the students that I was working with, I wanted them to be involved in something like this, because it was, I don't know, it's just something like you go through life every day, and we almost lose our ability to see things that are around us. We, you know, we walk by things all the time, but something about going, crossing the border, being out of my comfort zone, seeing with different eyes, gave me the opportunity to see the poor like I had never seen the poor before. And then I was able to go with an organization that was actually working with local people on the ground. And that was my first exposure to this idea of really, how do we do projects with people? So that kind of set the stage. That was back in 1991. And that really changed the trajectory of my life.
You had to be a puppy. You're not that old, man. You had to be a puppy in 91.
Ah, no, I'm, I'll turn the big 6-0 next year.
No way. No way. You look so, you look 15 years younger than that.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I've experienced similar experiences since joining Wells of Life back in March of 2017. And I have an answer to that question myself, and they're really simple. There are three reasons I am. It's not that I ignore domestic need, but my you know, the mainstay of what my family participates in is international need. And first is, like you said, there is an acute poverty. When you go into rural villages in outback Africa, you know, you're seeing something you just simply do not see here. You're seeing poverty on a whole different level. And you're seeing the likelihood not just of making their lives better and getting them into college, you're saving lives. You're keeping people from dying. And also, secondly, the vastness of international issues of need, and there is just a lack of aid by wealthy Western countries. I believe the United States, you know, not the government, but the donations in the United States, less than 4% of our donated money goes internationally. It's really not a lot of money going there. And then the third thing is really kind of, it almost is, I don't want it to sound selfish, but it's, you know, I just call it quite simply, it's bang for the buck. I give $5,000 internationally, and it is equal to $25,000 or $50,000 here. You know, it goes so far. And so far, and what I mean is it helps so many more people. There are so many individual lives impacted. So I've become a real believer in international service.
Yeah, it is all those things, you know. You literally can go in, and especially in what you guys are doing, whether or not you're drilling wells or you're putting water filters in sometimes a day, a couple days, sometimes a few hours, you're going to go in and change somebody's life right there on the spot. I mean, they're going to be drinking bacteria soup every day out of the local river or the local creek. And with these kinds of interventions, you can go in, and the bang for the buck is incredible, because you're going to affect entire populations of villages, you know, home by home, that are now going to be drinking clean, healthy water, and they're going to thrive. Their sicknesses are going to go away in a matter of a few weeks, and their babies will not die anymore, and they'll get to grow up and see their next birthday, which is
and they get to go to school, and we don't have these diarrhea issues, you know, that are just widespread. You know, we have so many different things. And I want to talk to you about, you know, my audience is familiar with my Wells of Life and drilling of wells. You have a different protocol that you use with Sawyer filters. And we met late last year, late 2019, to discuss the use of the product that you are international director of Sawyer filters for 300 families in Uganda that we were serving that had no access for clean water for us to drill in. There were no aquifers. We couldn't drill water. We had promised them water, and we were just up a creek. And then you came along and said, hey, we've got these water filters that can serve your need, and I would love to explain Sawyer filters to our audience.
Yeah. Well, Sawyer's is actually an outdoor company here in the U.S. And so we have primarily water filters, insect repellents, and we have some sunscreens and, you know, some first aid supplies and things. And so you'll find us in REIs and Walmart and Amazon, all those kind of places. But on the international side, we really focus on clean water. We have a small little gravity-fed water filter. It's the number one filter out on the hiking trail, you know, the outdoor trekkers and everybody that use it in the U.S., backpackers and everything. But this is, we've developed it in such a way where that small little gravity-fed filter can be attached to something like a 20-liter bucket, a 5-gallon bucket, which there's buckets in every foreign country. And you can literally take water from any fresh water source, so a contaminated well.
Or, yeah, filthy water source, you know, a fresh water source, yeah. But it's a filthy water source.
Yeah, just terrible. It's just like it is literally bacteria soup and coming straight out of a river, a creek, whatever the water source is. And in many of these countries, like, you know, Uganda, Liberia, different places like that, they have lots of surface water that's available. And so the filter works with a technology called a hollow fiber membrane. They use hollow fiber membranes in kidney dialysis, actually, to filter blood from pathogens and everything. But this filter really functions, I like to say it functions kind of like a microscopic net. It has these little hollow fiber tubes, and the pore size, or the holes in it, are so small, 0.1 microns in size, that no bacteria can pass through that filter. So all of the bacteria and everything larger than the bacteria actually gets filtered out and trapped inside the filter. And so you can filter a 5-gallon bucket in about 30 minutes and have potable water right on the spot. And what's really great about the filters is because they're mechanical, there's no, there's nothing like carbon or anything like that inside the filters. It's literally a mechanical micro pore size. You can take water, and we give you a couple different ways to do this, but you can backflush or backwash this filter for years and years and years of use. And so it's just such a simple little filter that's so profound. And every time I demo it, or every time we take it to a village, and we take that dirty, brown, you know, contaminated water, and we, you know, filter it through a bucket, and then we take a drink, you know, often that's what we do in the village, you know, we'll take the first drink, and, you know, people around the world, especially in Africa, they have started to name this the miracle filter or the miracle bucket, because it literally will change their lives right on the spot.
Now, I know you've you know, one of your center of operations is Liberia. How many filters, you know, individual family filters do you have in Liberia?
Well, we got involved in Liberia in 2015, actually started installing filters in 2016. And we, this year, were involved with a group that had a mission to get border-to-border clean water in every household for every man, woman, and child in Liberia by December of this year. And so we got involved with that, and through an anonymous donor, we were able to bring 130,000 Sawyer filters into the most remote bush jungle villages, people that were off the grid, you know, places that you couldn't get to. You were talking about there are literally places that you can't get a well rig into.
Right.
And these guys are way out in the boondocks. You know, you drive as far as you can drive. You cross a river, and then you hike 4 to 6 hours into the middle of the jungle. And that's where the people groups were living. And so we have tracked them all, and we are on course this year, December of 2020, that Liberia will be the first developing nation with border-to-border clean water through a combination of hand pump wells that were drilled and repaired and 130,000 Sawyer water filters all throughout the country.
That is amazing. That is so spectacular. So an entire country. Well, here's something that will impress our audience. So tell me about the change in waterborne diseases before and after the Sawyer filters.
Yeah, so we actually spend a lot of time teaching the nonprofits that we work with how to collect data. And so we were involved in a really big research project through some universities here in the States where all of the groups went out and they measured diarrhea rates, they measured purchase water costs, medical costs, they measured the work days that were missed by adults from waterborne sickness and the school days that were missed by kids. And in Liberia, when we started out at the baseline, 36% of the homes in Liberia reported frequent diarrhea rates before they received the water filter.
And when we say frequent, we really mean frequent.
Yeah. I mean, it's that's three or more. What we would say in the academic world, it would be three or more loose stools per day. That would be the technical term of how it's defined.
Okay.
And so, so that was going on at a 36% of the household rate. And we tracked that, and we sent teams back out after 2 weeks of receiving the filter, and then they tracked the same questions. And then at the eight-week mark, they tracked the same questions. So we went from 36% of the households 2 weeks later down to 2.9% of the households. And at the eight-week mark, dropped all the way down to 1.5% of the households only with frequent diarrhea. And, you know, you're not going to get rid of all the diarrhea from just cleaning up the water, but a 95% reduction in diarrhea rates in just a few weeks. And at the one-year mark, one-year spot check, we even saw the 0 to 4-year-olds go down into the 0.6% range, which was, you know, they're the most vulnerable.
So you're definitely impacting infant mortality then.
Yeah, it's just a dramatic decrease in those kinds of sicknesses, and you know the village is thriving. We did the same thing in the country of Fiji, and a different university measured. They were focusing more on the economic benefits of the filter, and so between purchased water savings, medical savings associated with waterborne sickness, and work days that were recaptured by the adults, we found that with every filter that went in, we were able to put $52.96 per month back into the pockets of each Fijian family that received one of those filters.
And what is their what is their income per month? Do you know?
That's about for a lower wage, you know, kind of minimum wage, kind of basic wage. That's about 1/8 of their salary. And so, very dramatic input. So for the cost. You know, filters don't even cost that much to put in, right? So
right.
The ROI, like you're saying, you with a minimal investment, the ROI is immediate, and within the first month, that's paid for. Now, not only are they thriving in a health sort of way, but they're also thriving with money they're saving for all these other things that they can now spend on school and education and food and different things like that for their family. So it's so many things that are affected when you clean up people's water.
Oh, so many. You know, we think about health, and we think about saving of lives. And you know, who knows? You know, it's difficult to measure how many lives are saved because that's like measuring a negative. But there are just, I'm sure, tens of thousands of lives saved. But you know, another thing that's I don't think mentioned frequently enough. Is the whole quality of life, back to work, back to school, no stunted growth, you know, none of the disabling impacts of dirty water, and you're impacting that tremendously. I think it's incredible, Daryl, what you guys are doing.
That's a super fun project. You know, we're in over 100 countries, and
Are you really? You're in 100 countries?
Yeah, that's where the soy filters are being used all over the world.
So how much time do you spend at home?
Well, during this COVID outbreak, all my travel was canceled. But the last couple of years doing projects, I would say pretty much half the time I was gone, and half the time here. And, you know, the air miles rack up in the 200,000 plus, you know, going all over the place. I just hit my 50th country this year.
50th country total or 50th country in a year?
That I visited. No, total. Altogether. It went to my 50th, yeah.
And yeah, so, you know, I don't have quite that many, but I have not too far from that many, but mine is all pleasure. I really love international travel.
It's great.
You know, that's kind of an overview of where we're going. I want to, an overview of where we are. I want to get into the subject that is just so poignant with me, so strong, and I am looking at I'm trying to find. You know, I had notes and I lost my place in my notes. Oh, here we go. Now, as you and I have chatted in the last few days, if you and I and all NGOs and supporters of not only international charities or causes, but same thing with national causes. If we are not careful, our giving can be severely limiting to communities when we give without any consideration of empowering these same communities to manage our gifts on their own. That these gifts become gifts. And they now become property, and we empower the people. And our role becomes to function as consultants and facilitators, not as the typical foreigner, deep pocket, we've got you covered, don't worry about it, we'll take care of all your needs. Because we're not really helping people when we do that. We're really disempowering them and actually, you know, losing aspiration, their, you know, self-determination, you know, there's just so many negatives about it.
Sure. Yeah, it is both internationally and locally, you find that phenomenon. And I always like to preface what we're talking about. There's always room for one of the great stories that I love about the Good Samaritan, who sees somebody in need and just helps, like, right on the spot and, you know, takes care of this person in need. So there's always room for that. But the longer term development kinds of things, sometimes we can enable, we can, you know, go in thinking that we're doing something good when we're not really helping, but we can be hurting. And oftentimes I find that when we go in, I've seen many organizations and stuff that will go in and they think of something they want to do, and it's always goodwill.
Always great intention. Great intention.
Yeah, great. Yeah, they want to do something well. They want to use their skill sets and those kind of things. But oftentimes we'll go in and what I would say, go do a project to someone. They're going to show up. They're going to do this thing, and it's going to be to them. And they haven't maybe worked with locals. It's you know, you just give these free things away or whatever it is. And as a result, you don't. So oftentimes even address needs that are real needs in the community. We can do it locally. You know, we're going to think that we're going to go down and do something to someone or give something away or something like that. And we haven't addressed what the real systemic needs are in the community and actually listened to the community and listened to what their needs are. And sometimes we'll find that what we're doing is not what is needed. And so I found it way more of a, you know, like a, what I would say, a better approach to actually do things with people. to listen, to do in this, you know, in the States, we have a lot of community-based development that seeks a lot of input from the communities and those kind of things to develop real systems that will help, you know, in the long term. In international, we would do the same thing. You know, we want to involve locals in the project, so much so that really, I really believe that when we go and, you know, you're doing clean water projects, we're doing clean water projects with Sawyer, you know, well, whether or not it's wells, filters, or whatever we're doing. But when we do it, you know, we want to raise up people that can sustain those projects. You know, you guys are looking at building up local teams that know how to not only install the wells themselves, they've been trained to do that, but they know how to repair them. You look into maybe group savings accounts in villages where
yes.
villages can be a little bit more forward thinking and they can actually save in advance for some of those, you know, small repairs that in the past groups have gone in and maybe installed wells in different places and they didn't raise up locals that can sustain the project. And, you know, a $10 O-ring can go out in a well and it takes the whole pump out and it takes the whole village out with their clean water. And so those are the kind of things where it's, you know, somebody went in, they did a great project and it worked for a while, but how do we do a better job at sustaining things by building capacity in locals and listening to them and inviting them in the project and then watching them actually grow, creating socioeconomic opportunities for them, small entrepreneurial businesses where they can long-term sustain those projects and care for their families in those kind of ways. So those are two different approaches, right?
Yeah.
And both have good intentions, but one actually has a longer approach.
You know, I've got two comments on that.
Yeah.
One is the district that we're doing a lot of our we're going to be moving almost all of our operation restoration, which we go in and we rehabilitate wells that are non-functional. They are not wells of life wells that are non-functional. They've been drilled by other NGOs or by the government. They're in this particular district, there are more than 300 non-functional wells. And some of these wells have been non-functional for a year. Some have been non-functional for 10 years. And sometimes it's a matter of $100 to fix them. It's just nothing. But they've gone without water for all this time. And we're making that one of our main initiatives we're thinking for next year is just making this like you made Liberia, a clean water. We want to make it all the wells are functional within a period of 4 years of trying to do 80 a year. But something else occurred to me. Now, back on the other subject about working to rather than working with, isn't that when we go in with our resources and our money and we build schools and we build wells, and then we try to take control over them, try to manage them. Is that not sort of a conflated process of colonialism?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly can go in and, you know, almost create welfare societies.
Yes.
That are dependent on that. They can't stand on their own 2 feet, you know, or whatever, because we've created this system where we go in and, you know, perhaps Americans are managing everything and doing all that. And it's okay to be like involved in the project and stuff, but you really want to empower and equip and build capacity in those that live locally. So much so that if you were, think about if NGOs were to go in and do these projects and build capacity, if you were to leave, what would happen? And some of the best NGOs that I know, that their founders have gone in and done great work, and they continue to do great work, the best ones that I know, if the founders of that organization that might have come from the States or somewhere else, Europe or somewhere, if they were to leave, that thing would still keep going.
And it's so difficult, Daryl, because you know we're dealing with cultures that have not really been very much empowered other than farming and, you know, raising cattle. And there's, you know, there's not a lot of responsibility. So you're bringing in a Western mindset, and that is a whole year. So you're talking major cultural change. This is not a simple thing. And let's come back to that after we take a brief break. And we'll come back to that with some other ideas about types of giving. So we'll take a break right now. This is Charlie Hedges, and you are listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie, and I am on the phone with veteran philanthropical international expert Daryl Larson, and we are talking about the very challenging concept of when helping hurts, and that if we just give money without teaching or not so much teaching, but encouraging empowerment of the local communities to take charge of their own communities, we are almost doing them a disservice. And we had just ended up talking about, you'll have to remind me what we were talking about that I want to go on with, Daryl.
We're just talking about, you know, what it's like to build capacity. And if we were to leave, you know, if like we go in or someone goes in as a founder and they were to leave, would the things that we're doing continue on? Because there is capacity built in the local level. And, you know, that's easier said than done. It takes a lot of work and a lot of effort to be able to go on that journey and to value other cultures' input and their ability and esteem them and invite them into the process and walk side by side with them and you know, take them on that kind of a journey. And actually, you know, in a sense, you hand the keys over to them and they're able to sustain these things. And in our specific case, how do you do that with water, right? How do you do that with water wells when you drill them? And are there teams on the ground that when you leave have the ability and the capacity to, you know, and the foresight to save a little bit of money? That's a process all by itself, is to teach, you know, concepts like group savings and village and those kind of things. But are there people on the ground that actually can fix those wells and repair them?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what we do, and it's a process. As you know, anytime you get into large corporate or government or international affairs, acronyms are everything. You know, you've got to, you know, you have it. It's like alphabet soup with all these things. And there's an acronym called CBMS, which is Community Based Management System. And what we do with our wells, for instance, when we drill a well, we send our people and we create a water user committee. Water user committee is about 11 people. The majority needs to be women, because women are the primary collectors of the water. And they see that it's done sanitary, that it's given, distributed equally, that there are times when the well is open, times when the well is closed. But they also create a bank account, a amount of money that is very low. That costs the individual user 50 shillings, and I have to let me. I think it's 3 cents that it costs them for a 5-gallon bucket of water, and all that money. It's not. We're not making the money. The community is not making the money. They are saving the money for when the well becomes, a part breaks on it and it becomes non-functional. They have the resources to employ a well mechanic to come out and repair them. Now, that in and of itself sounds great, That sounds like, oh, man, you guys really got it together. But you have to understand that people are not always in communities for forever. So water user committees members could change. And in 2 or 3 years, they have not been trained by us. And we just don't have the capacity to go back and train, retrain everybody all the time. So, you know, there's a battle at hand that we recognize it. We try to do the best we can, but you have cultural issues, and especially in rural areas, you know, you don't have the urban government agencies. You know, you just have a group of people with a chief and a couple of officials, and they're the ones that are in charge of everything. But we do what we can to train people to they take ownership. And we have contracted with a well maintenance, preventive maintenance organization that is partnering with us. We're just starting this year with them. We're very excited that they will encourage and work with the people to set up a bank account and get all of the monies involved. And when they do that, this group will do preventive maintenance. They will visit every well once a month to check out to see, is a seal looks like it's on its way out? So instead of waiting until it breaks, they do preventive maintenance. They replace it right away so we don't have a non-functioning well. So that is, and they're with them for years. They're with them for a minimum of 5 years that they're working with them. So we're very excited about that. But we do really believe in community empowerment. We work very hard at it.
Yeah, no, you guys do a great job. I saw it firsthand. I got to be with you guys in January and over in Uganda, and it was really impressive to see how you guys have everything set up. And, you know, your donors have to be really, really pleased to be a part of something like that, where, the ROI on everything is just being done so well and so inclusive of the locals and everything. So it was really good to see firsthand for myself.
Yeah, and we're just so fortunate that we have such excellent staffing in Uganda. We have only one expatriate. He's our country director. He's from Romania, and everybody else is national. Our deputy country director is Ugandan, and everybody in our, you know, in our operation is Ugandan. So everybody is local. It's not a bunch of, excuse me, but white people going in there fixing everything. It's local, so they have much more credibility, and they can speak a language that we can't speak. Not only the actual language, but they're much more they're listened to more than we are. Now, what I want to talk about, and this was something I added one. I don't know if you're going to approve of this, but you told me about two types of giving that are very important. I added a third one because I read it. I didn't just make it up. I read it, but I want to make sure you agree with it. This is simplifying it, but there's three essential types of giving internationally to various situations. The first one is relief giving. And relief giving is when you have sort of environmental catastrophic tsunamis, floods, earthquakes, you know, whatnot. That just needs, there's no development. You're wasting your time with development. You need to give them money so they can rebuild and they can get right back into the game.
Yeah, or resources. And one of the premises of When Helping Hurts is if you try to give a development effort in a relief context. So development has a lot of red tape and a lot of planning and a lot of processing and all that stuff. But relief needs relief right now. Like my water went out, or we had a tsunami, or we had an earthquake, or whatever. I need food now. I need resources now. It doesn't need red tape. And so if we try to give it a development effort with a lot of planning and all that kind of stuff, it doesn't help. It hurts.
Yeah, we had the same case with Louisiana. We just had to help rebuild. There was no, let's create these infrastructures. We got to get things working, then we can start working on infrastructure.
Right. And consequently, the same kind of thing happens when you go into a place and you have an expectation that you want things to last and sustain, but you give more of what I would say a relief effort. And so you go, let's say in the context of water filters or something like that, you go in, you take a water filter, you drop it off, you do minimal training, and you haven't focused on behavior change and all of the things that it takes, you know, to adapt to any new technology. And so we kind of drop things off, go, and give a relief effort, and we expect long-lasting results, and that doesn't work either. That doesn't help. We've taken donors' money, and we've really, in a sense, wasted it because we haven't focused on changing the behaviors of people, which takes time, follow-up, continuing education, all of
and more things. Resources. It takes a bunch. It's easy to go in and drill a well and run.
Yeah,
you know, and you've got 300 abandoned wells in one district.
Yeah, so on one level, you would say, oh, it costs more to do development. I would argue the opposite. It costs more to do relief because when you go in and do relief, you go in and spend all the money, and then it doesn't last. Sometimes it doesn't last very long at all, and then you have to go back and do it again, and then do it again, and do it again.
That's true. That you know, I think that's a good point. And what you're getting into is what I got into my second one. So forgive me for adding one. That's why I said relief. I wanted to make relief strictly contingent upon sort of disaster and catastrophe. And then the one I read about alleviation of poverty is taking the relief concept and putting it into alleviating poverty by just going in and throwing money at it and walking away. And so, it's semantical. So we can still deal with relief. It doesn't make a difference to me. But I so agree with you that you just can't go in and throw money at it because it is striking me. And only now, after considering it for a little while now and just recently hit me, it really smacks of colonialism. It really does. It makes a total dependence on an outside resource. It does not develop any kind of internal self-confidence, self-determination that we believe in our capacity and our capability to deal with our own problems now that we have these tools and these resources like a filter or a well or who knows what all. We're talking water, so we know, you know, we're very familiar with those areas, that they can take charge of that rather than a colonial comes in and says, we'll put it in. If it's broken, we'll come in and fix it. So everybody is depending on the deep pockets that's coming in. They're, you know, the rurals and the communities and the villagers think, you know, why do we have to do anything if deep pockets is going to come and take care of it? And it just doesn't work that way. And it is, I believe, so much in the developmental.
We actually do a disservice, I think, to people living in third world countries because, they live in different conditions, and oftentimes poverty is about choices and opportunity, and they just don't have opportunity. But that doesn't mean they're dumb or they don't know things or whatever. They're actually quite brilliant and quite smart and very capable. I think that going in, you know, everybody wants to use their gifts and their abilities and their resources. Not everybody, but I mean, the idea would be that we would all strive for that, right? Where we would take the giftings that we have, the resources that we have, and be able to use those around the world to make a difference. But I think that needs to come with a healthy dose of humility and a healthy dose of esteeming other people. We need to get rid of the hero concept that we're, you know, out to be the heroes of the world, but that we're actually there to be cooperative and
to serve
cooperative efforts. Yeah, and to serve, really. And so we don't, when we go in with the attitude that we're here to serve. How can we best serve you? How can we best help meet your needs? What are those needs? What does that look like? I think that goes a long way towards respecting the brilliant, bright people that live in countries that maybe they don't have as many opportunities with education and different things like that we have experienced maybe in our country, in the U.S. But we should have a very healthy dose of humility as we go in, and not go in with that, you know, we're here to save the day.
Yeah, and that we are all equal. We're not the savior of the world, Americans, or the savior of the world, Europeans, or whatever, you know, pick any nation you want to pick, that saving the world, Chinese. You know, we're not any of those. That we are, I love your idea of humility, that we do go in with humility, respect, acceptance. You know, it's amazing how far respect
goes. And to
goes.
Be learners.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Is that you're in a learning end. But, you know, I was going to say to go in with respect. I find when I go into communities or rural villages, and I respect the elders and respect the leadership, you know, you can tell that they are genuinely moved by it, to the degree that we can translate, you know, not knowing each other's language. But, you know, you're just not going in, you know, looking for the special seat, the front seat of the, like you know, it says in the Bible, don't take the front seat at the banquet, so you're pushed to the back seat. Take the back seat and be invited up to the front seat. And that's kind of the attitude that we need to go with. But you know what strikes me is that to our listeners, now many of our listeners cannot get involved. They just don't have the time to get involved in the developmental aspects, that they are really, their primary gift is their treasure. Their primary gift is writing a check. That is the one thing they can do. But I would really encourage everybody to investigate the nonprofit or the NGO or the source that you're giving money to see, are they development or are they throwing money at things? Because the more we just throw money at things, the less effective it is. We have to train people, encourage people, build up their... It's, you know, I've been reading later, I thought it was esteem, but that's a very, very American idea. It's to build up their aspiration and their self-determination to take care of themselves, that we can take care of themselves. Because we're talking about very proud individuals, and I don't mean in the negative sense of pride, but I mean they are proud that they have farms, and they're proud that they have cattle that they're raising, and they could feed their children. This is a mark of success in society, and if we can assist that, at the same time keep people healthy, we're really doing a job. And so I would encourage givers to really check out this aspect. It's not an aspect that you even think of, but check out this aspect. Is your charity, whether it's a NGO or 501c3 or whatever, are they developers or are they relievers?
And again, you know, there is room for both, most certainly. You know, when you have relief, there are certain charities that's what they do.
But that's emergency, isn't it, Daryl? Isn't that more of an emergency
in
line with disaster? That's a different kind. You're right. Let's be clear on that. That's a whole. We're talking totally different things. We're talking the places that we have an opportunity for a longer term impact.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, in that sense. So if you go in, throw money at something and don't change behavior, or you don't work with the people or whatever, that can oftentimes not translate very good in a culture.
I tell you, just to give you an idea of the, it is to develop these programs. It is really easy to be. Now I want to go back to my alleviation of poverty rather than relief, because relief is kind of disaster related. But when we just go throw money at a project, we build a well and bolt. That's really easy. You know, we do a well for $6,000, which is $4,000 under most everybody else's price, if not more than that. 1,000 people are impacted. We're now doing studies with another company that you're working for, as if you don't work for enough companies. But another company you're working with, and we're really doing very sound data collection. And by fourth quarter, end of the year, we're going to have a lot of data that shows, like you, that shows the decrease in diarrhea, the health, and that we're going to be able to do that. But that requires a lot of effort, Daryl. I mean, that's not, you know, it's so easy to go in and drill a well and bolt. Instead of, if we do our wash, you know, our water sanitation and hygiene, that's a minimum of a 9-month educational process of teaching plus empowering, teaching people to take charge, what they take charge of, how they take charge of it. And then it takes it takes 1 to 2 years to follow up on that.
Sure. Yeah, it is a lot of effort, and again, it's getting into the systems and taking the time to have the right resources and taking the time and effort for continuing education and really focusing on behavior change, all those kind of things. And it does take more work. It takes more resources actually to do it, but I would say, again, you know, some people would say it's cheaper to go where you just drill the well and you go away. Well, not really, because when the well breaks, you got to go in and now they need another one. And so you got to spend that $6,000 again. So it's not really cheaper. I would say it would be more short-sighted to think that you could go drop something off and expect it to sustain itself when you haven't dealt with all of the other things.
Yeah,
it's that way with everything.
It's that way when we buy materials. You know, you can buy at a certain store and get a really discount price, and you're having to go and buy every 6 to 9 months that thing over again. Whether you pay when you pay a higher price, it may last 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, and it's the same in the U.S. You know, when we're dealing with other issues like homelessness and mental health and all of those kind of things, there's not a quick Band-Aid for those things. It's you got to get down and dirty into the trenches to love people and meet people where they are. I've been on that road, you know, personally in my own life, maybe for another subject at another time, but, you know, just working with someone, we had a homeless guy that lived with us for about 4 out of the 6 years that he was alive in the last years of his life. And when we met him, almost every day was a bad day. And when he passed away, almost every day was a good day. But I'll tell you, it was one step forward, two steps back, a lot of days. Those things are hard work to help with the transformation of life. But it's so worth it and so rewarding, whether or not it's wells or filters or in our own backyards, to put in the kind of effort that really is transformational.
Yeah, I just don't even want to get into the subject, but here I go. But it is true in the United States that we have to be careful. There is a place that we need to throw money at certain things, but are we really doing cultural developmental work that is really necessary, or are we just dealing with symptoms and not causes? When you're throwing money at something, you're dealing with symptoms. You're not dealing with causes. And those are issues that we all need to ask ourselves. But we're talking about developing world countries, and we know for a fact that I totally agree with you. It's more expensive to do the throw the money in bolt than it is to spend a little bit more money up front and have this thing last longer. Daryl, you just do fine work. You are so knowledgeable in this subject, and I want to thank you for coming on the air to talk about this, because this is the first time I've even begun to broach such a subject as this, and I think it's really important, and it was your idea, and I love your idea. Thank you so much for that. I really appreciate it.
No, it's my pleasure. Anytime. I love the work that you guys are doing. It's for your listeners who have been listening for a long time, and your donors that have been listening for a long time and know the work of Wells of Life. It's the real deal, and I've seen it firsthand with my own life. So what you guys are doing, my hat's off to you and the great efforts that you guys are making in the people's lives in Uganda. It's awesome.
And, you know, and I have to throw in the commercial. If you want to get a hold of us, it's just simple, wellsoflife.org. And we will explain everything we do. And Sawyer Filters, what are you, sawyerfilters.org?
No, it's sawyer.com.
Sawyer, well, it's a .com, sawyer.com.
Yeah.
I'll put them both in the show notes so people can look them up and see the different services and how we're both giving water to poor people. So thank you so much for spending time with me today, Daryl.
You're welcome, Charlie. My pleasure.
And I also want to thank our listeners for tuning in to The Next Chapter with Charlie. And be sure to check us out at our website, thenextchapter.life. And until next, this is Charlie Hedges signing off. Bye for now.